We have a quorum. We'll call the meeting of the Higher Education Finance Committee to order. And first order of business would be the minutes, if somebody would care to offer the minutes.
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Carlson moves minutes from Wednesday, February 28th. Any discussion? All in favor of the minutes? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? I guess I did that prematurely, but minutes are approved. All right. First order of business today is House File 67. Just a long debate here. I have to confess to the members that I've got a left ear that's not working well as a result of a cold that I've been experiencing. So, speak up loud and clear.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For purposes of expediting this, I would move House File 67.
Representative Bopatz moves House File 67 and for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Is that what you're saying? Okay.
Mr. Chair, we already spent some time last week discussing reciprocity with Higher Education Services Office was here, and then we also heard some concerns from the University of Minnesota, so I'm not sure we have to revisit all of that, but I think this will be an opportunity to look at this particular piece of legislation that I've introduced. It actually is a relatively soft proposal in the form of asking HESO to do some reporting on exactly what the status of the various agreements are. It encourages them to re-examine the relationship that we have with South Dakota, and it also encourages them to, as soon as possible, commence negotiations with the state of Wisconsin on tuition reciprocity, particularly on the issue we were discussing last week with respect to the discrepancy between the tuition rate paid by Wisconsin residents and those paid by our own Minnesota students. And that discrepancy, as we heard, is growing quite substantially. I thought it would be helpful. One thing we didn't talk about was the study that the legislative auditor did a couple of years ago because of concerns raised by this body, the House and Senate, with respect to these agreements. And so I thought this would be a good chance to let them share with the committee some of their findings, both positive and areas of concern. So with that.
Welcome to the committee, and if you would identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Joel Alter, and I'm with the Legislative Auditor's Office, and Representative Opatz mentioned it was in September 2003 when we issued the report that you've got in front of you there that looked at the tuition reciprocity agreement that agreements that Minnesota has with South Dakota, North Dakota, and Wisconsin. And I'm going to be fairly brief here. I do want to say a few words about what we found and recommended in the report, and then I'll come back to in a moment some items that relate specifically to the provisions in Representative Opatz's bill. As I said, we could just start with a few general observations about tuition reciprocity that we made in the report. We concluded that this is a program that is pretty unique in the country, and it provides some very important benefits. First, the goal of the program is to expand student academic options, and we found that Minnesota's agreements have done that. We did a representative survey of Minnesotans who left the state to attend school in one of the reciprocity states. We found that most of the students that we surveyed said that they went to the out-of-state schools for some academic-related reason. Maybe they went there to enroll in a program that they simply couldn't find at a Minnesota school, or maybe they thought that the quality of the program at an out-of-state school was somewhat better than they could find at a Minnesota school. Most of the students that we surveyed said that they would not have enrolled in their non-Minnesota school had it not been for the reciprocity program. So this is an important program that has, in fact, affected student decisions and has helped give students some additional options. Second, the program attracts good students to Minnesota institutions. And by that I mean when you look at the average ACT scores of the reciprocity students that are coming to the University of Minnesota and to the Minsky institutions. The reciprocity student scores are above average. And so that's one of the reasons why when you talk with the people in the institutions, the Minsky and the U of M, they're generally positive about this program. They get some pretty good students that come to Minnesota from elsewhere. And finally, it's true that we sometimes talk about Minnesota being a net exporter of reciprocity students, and by that we mean that if you look at the inflow and the outflow, we actually have more Minnesota students that leave the state to participate in this program than we have students from the reciprocity states who come to Minsky and U of M institutions. And at first you might look at that and say, well, that's a point of concern. In fact, one of the things that we found in this report is that a very large percentage of the reciprocity students, after they graduate from school in another state, come back to Minnesota and work here. And in the meantime, the students who come here to enroll as reciprocity students, particularly at the University of Minnesota and to a somewhat less degree at Minsky institutions, we do a pretty good job of retaining those students here in Minnesota after graduation as workers. So I think, as you may have discussed at a previous hearing, to some extent the inflow and the outflow relates to where the population of students are coming from. We have a large population in the Twin Cities area right on the border. We've got some border institutions, particularly in Wisconsin, that attract some of those students. But again, the good news is that we found that many of those students come back to Minnesota as workers after they finish school. So our report had a lot of positive things to say about the tuition reciprocity program. We think that it's a program that's worth keeping. Our report did raise some issues for the legislature and the Higher Education Services Organization to consider. And I know that some of these are issues that have come up in your previous discussion, so I won't spend a long time on them, but let me mention just a few things. Regarding Minnesota's agreement with Wisconsin, we noted that Wisconsin students attending Minnesota schools, particularly the U of M, pay lower tuition than Minnesota students pay at the same institutions. I think the issue here is really a fairness issue. And as you heard University of Minnesota officials say a week or two ago, for them it's become a particular concern and something that they would like to see changed. We laid out some options by which the interstate agreement could address this. For example, requiring students covered by the agreement to pay the higher of the two states' resident tuition rates, which is the type of agreement that we have with North Dakota and South Dakota. Or, presently we have a surcharge on students at the Twin Cities campus of the University of Minnesota, whereby the Wisconsin students who come here pay a somewhat larger amount than they otherwise would pay to help make that gap a little bit narrower between the Minnesota and the Wisconsin tuition rates. That surcharge is not in effect for the other three campuses of the University of Minnesota, and so another option would be to have a surcharge like that or a larger surcharge potentially that would be in place at the U of M campuses. It's also important to consider, and we discuss this at length in the report, that at least under the current agreement, this kind of a policy change could have a cost for Minnesota taxpayers. That is, unless there were some way for the state to capture some portion of that increase in tuition that the Wisconsin students would be paying to the Minnesota institutions with this kind of a change, there would be a larger obligation for an interstate payment that Minnesota would face under this kind of a change. So in short, it's clearly possible to identify ways to change the interstate agreement with Wisconsin to address the fairness issue. There are clearly things that could be included in the agreement that would address that issue. At the same time, it's important to consider whether there would be some fiscal implications for the state of Minnesota to consider. We didn't make specific recommendations about any of the particular options for changing the agreement. We did recommend that at a minimum, I mentioned that there is a surcharge that's in place at the Twin Cities campus, and we thought that, again, from a fairness perspective, from a consistency perspective, it probably made sense to extend that to Wisconsin students at the other U of M campuses as well. And so that was the recommendation we made, suggesting that as a minimum step to take. Regarding the agreement with South Dakota, In Minnesota's agreement with Wisconsin, as I mentioned, there have been annual interstate payments. And the idea behind the interstate payments is that one state can compensate the other state, and the state that gets the compensation is the one that is bearing the larger amount of taxpayer costs that result from educating these reciprocity students. The Minnesota-South Dakota reciprocity agreement has provisions for interstate payments. And in fact, if you look at South Dakota law, the law requires that a payment be made to the state that serves the larger number of reciprocity students. At the present time, and for the last few years, that would be Minnesota. That is, if there were an interstate payment being made, it would be a payment from South Dakota to Minnesota. But one of the things that we found is that there haven't been interstate payments made between Minnesota and South Dakota since 1988. Again, we raised this issue because at least at the moment, Minnesota would be a recipient of those payments, so there was a fiscal impact that we thought that that had. We thought this issue needed some legislative attention, and we thought it needed the attention of PISO as it discussed potential changes to the agreement with South Dakota. One other issue I want to just highlight that we talked about in the report is the general issue of legislative oversight. We noted that Minnesota law is not particularly prescriptive in what it says about the reciprocity agreements. There's a fair amount of latitude that HESO has to negotiate the agreements. The University of Minnesota and Minsky governing boards must approve any agreements that are entered into by HESO. The agreements are not subject to the legislature's approval, and I should mention that that's different than the provisions of Wisconsin and South Dakota laws regarding reciprocity agreements. We noted that in general there's been fairly limited review of tuition reciprocity, and so we recommended some changes in the law to address this. And some of the things that we suggested is that HESO should provide additional information to the legislature on an annual basis. Kind of nice to have some musical accompaniment. One of the things that HESO does is every year they work out an annual memoranda with the state that they have agreements with. And there are some changes in those annual memoranda that can be important. And we suggested that the legislature, for example, require that HESO share those memoranda with the legislature and with these committees, that HESO share with the legislature the calculations regarding interstate payments that are done every year. I think our general concern was just that the legislature be kept in the loop on this. And we even went to the point of suggesting that the legislature consider requiring reauthorization of the program every few years. I know there was some nervousness about that last year because there was concern about whether students might think that the program was going to go away if there was some sort of a sunset provision. But I think that the general point that we were trying to make is that this is an important program, and there are fiscal implications to the program, and periodically it's good for the legislature to take a look at what those implications are. So overall, we concluded that the reciprocity program is a valuable one, but we also think there are some issues that deserve continued attention. We recognize that interstate agreements can't just be changed unilaterally, and we also recognize that there's room for discussion about the right way to make any possible changes in what the terms of the agreements are. We think it's healthy to continue to talk about some of those possible changes so that everybody who's involved in these agreements at least perceive them to be fair and equitable and beneficial to students. So that's in a nutshell what we said in our report.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, could you review for me again the you said South Dakota has not paid since 1988. Does your report tell us what we would have received accumulatively had they made those payments? And if HESO made us aware of that, I've forgotten, which is entirely possible, but I don't ever recall that being drawn to my attention, at any rate, that we had a state that was in the arrears by that amount of time.
Mr. Alter.
Mr. Chair and Representative Carlson, there is a discussion on starting at page 52 in the report if you're interested in what we have to say, but again, let me kind of hit some high points here. There were interstate payments made. They were usually not particularly large until 1988. And then in the discussions between HESO and its South Dakota counterpart at that time, I think South Dakota was concerned that potentially those interstate payments might grow. And so I think South Dakota initiated concerns about that and the suggestion that the payments be discontinued. When we talked with HESO about this, they said that at the time that they decided to reach an agreement with South Dakota not to pursue interstate payments. HESO said that they informed legislative leaders at the time about that. I think it has nonetheless been an issue that's kind of been under the radar screen since that time. In fact, when we talked with HESO about it at the time we issued this report, they weren't aware that there was a provision in South Dakota law that required that the state that received the larger number of students would receive an interstate payment. So it's one of those issues that I'm not sure we understand the exact history of exactly how we came to the point of not making the payments. But at least in the last few years, and this is one of those things that certainly can swing back and forth. I mean, there was a period of time when there were more students going to South Dakota institutions, and so arguably we would have been making some sort of an interstate payment at that time. But at least in recent years, the swing has been the other way. There have been more South Dakota students coming to Minnesota. And so we made an estimate as to what might be the interstate payment. But even that is a little bit tenuous because it's been so long since a payment was actually calculated. We discussed our estimate with HESO. We tried to make some reasonable assumptions about that, and I think we came to the judgment that it might be in the neighborhood of $300,000 or $400,000 per year. But again, even that, is something that if there were to be some reinstatement of the annual payments, there might be some new discussion about how to calculate those payments and whether the old method that was used is the right one. So that's a rough estimate.
A follow-up, Representative Grouse?
No, Mr. Chairman, is that, when we talk about that payment, is that the same kind of a settlement then that we have with other states like Wisconsin where we make the determination as to how many students have attended the various institutions and then one state or the other settles up and makes the payment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, there are some differences in the three agreements in the way that those payments are calculated, but essentially it's the same general idea.
That I'm talking about, Mr. Chairman, the general idea that, I'm not talking about, I know each one is a separate agreement. Now, Mr. Chairman, you mentioned South Dakota law was that they were supposed to pay if they owed. Is that language or is there payment language actually in the contract we have with South Dakota then?
Mr. Alter.
Mr. Chair and Representative Carlson, this is another area where it's complicated. What we have with South Dakota is we entered into an interstate a reciprocity agreement with South Dakota, and I seem to recall that the agreement that we initially entered into South Dakota may still be the one that we're operating under. If it's not, it was negotiated a long time ago. And so that agreement does, in fact, have provision for interstate payments. As I said, though, there are also these annual discussions that take place between HESO and its counterpart in the other states, and these kind of annual memoranda that are worked out that have to do with the details of the program, some details about how the interstate payments are calculated. And that's where you've still got the language in the reciprocity agreement itself, but in the annual memoranda, there's a provision that says there will be no interstate payments. And, I guess our interpretation is that the initial agreement probably should stand and that the other things are more administrative and that there may be some modifications. But I seem to remember that even in the South Dakota law that there was a provision that only certain things could be addressed in the annual memoranda, one of them was not interstate payments. So that's why we raised the issue.
And Mr. Chairman, if we took the low number, that's almost $5 million, at $300,000 per year, which you said was a rough guess. But
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, and I certainly don't want to say that it would have been that every year since 1988. HESO may want to comment, but I know that there were some years up through the middle 90s at least, maybe even into the late 90s, where the flow was in the other direction. And it was not always as large a difference in the inflow and outflow as it is now. I think now you've got a several hundred student difference with more students coming to Minnesota.
Mr. Chairman, I misunderstood. I thought you meant that it was 300,000 to 400,000 each year for the past 16 years or thereabouts. But maybe we can hear more on this then from the ESO folks. Maybe we're learning why South Dakota is a low-tax state. They don't pay their bills.
Representative Dempsey, you have a question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sir, I didn't get your name.
I'm Joel Alter.
Alter?
Alter, A-L-T-E-R.
And are you, I'm new to this committee, okay, so I don't know maybe as much about the system as some other people do, but let me just ask you a few questions, if I may. First of all, do you find this as a major problem that you or HESO are concerned about?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dempsey, I'd say that this report is a mixed picture. I think that what we said is that the bottom line is that this is a program that has benefited students, and you would hate to see anything in danger. The reciprocity agreements, to the extent that they provide better options for students. At the same time, I do think that there are equity issues that are raised by some of what I've talked about here today. There are certainly some questions about compliance, to the extent that an interstate payment was negotiated or is required by law, but it's not being made. Is that something that we want to just look past, or is it something that we want to deal with head on? So that's why we said they were worth taking some note of.
Representative Dempsey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Alter, why do we need another piece of legislation? Why don't we just give HESO or the organization it solved the problem and moved on? Why should, and I'm coming from my perspective, okay, it seems to me as though you can't, here we've got a situation where South Dakota is behind in its payments, and nothing's happening. Now, I don't know, that is that because of the legislation? Is that because of the incompetence of the organization? Is that simply because of the fact, well, the legislature determines what to do, so we don't do anything until the legislature does something? It seems to me here we've got a problem, and we've got high-quality people know their profession exceedingly well, dealing with the highest educated people in the state of Minnesota, and you're coming to the legislature, well, now we got to have the laws that are, forget the laws and just do the job. Can't we do that?
Mr. Alter. Mr. Chair, Representative Dempsey. And, I think Representative Opatz may want to comment on this too. I mean, certainly it is within HESO's authority to pursue, if they want to pursue, a change in the agreement with South Dakota or an enforcement of the existing agreement. They could certainly do that, and perhaps it's more just a frustration that we're at this point and that this issue has come up and just trying to maybe push it in that direction of doing something.
Representative Opatz?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dempsey, maybe I can share a little bit of my thoughts on this. The reason that I have, as I think some of you know, worked on this for a number of years is because of frustrations that I've had, not with the overall program, and I agree with the legislative auditor that this is an important idea, that it provides great options for thousands of students. It's generally good for Minnesota that we have these agreements, but for whatever reason, as the legislative auditor has pointed out, there are some problems with them, and we, for some reason, have not been able or have seen the Higher Education Services Office address them. And when I say that office, that we now have new leadership there, so this is not a reflection of the current leadership, but it is a concern about what happened in past years, even as far back as the 1980s. And so it was, in fact, because of our frustration, and not just mine, but this body, the House and the Senate, that led to us asking the legislative auditor to analyze these agreements and help us determine whether we should be taking a more active role legislatively in their oversight. So that's a little bit of history on why we're here today, looking at what amounts to a bill to try to tighten up the oversight.
Representative Dempsey.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sure that I can remember when this program was put online. It was put online because it would be a benefit to the various institutions. And it seems to me that now we're into a situation. I just had a student from up in northern Minnesota talk to me about, Mr. Dempsey, quite about freezing the costs of going to their local school, local state university, and so on. And here we've got a settlement of millions of dollars to South Dakota that we're not collecting. Holy buckets! I don't know why we can't fight. I don't understand why HESO or whoever. Why can't you act on that? How do you gather a $3 million deficit and it goes on and on and on and on? I don't get that.
Representative, this gentleman is from the Legislative Auditor's Office. Well, and HESO is in the room, and they'll have an opportunity.
Yeah, and I'm not mad at anybody. Right. It's just, holy buckets, you people are just as competent as I am sitting, well, I think you are. I'm not the smartest, swiftest guy in the block, but I mean, my point is when I was in school administration, we solved problems. We didn't have any money. We didn't have money at all. We came from a building that was built in 1928, was a fire trap and all the rest of it. But because of our creativity and problem solving, we were selected by three presidents of the United States as a school that can solve our own problems, okay? Three different presidents. And we did that simply because we solved problems. Now, if you can do that in a situation like that, it seems to me that the higher education, the top-notch intellectuals in the state of Minnesota, boy, we shouldn't have to be telling you what to do and how to do it. You should be doing this, and you have to do a study in regard to it. I was just... Now, maybe that isn't how the system functions, quite obviously. That isn't how the system functions, but I think giving you the autonomy, and that's one of the good things, I think, with the University of Minnesota. You know, we can do the funding, but we don't tell them how to run the operations, and we do a pretty doggone good job. And I would like to see the same thing happen with the state universities and the community colleges and all the rest of that, and the tech colleges and so on, to give them that authority. Now, maybe I'm off base and we need more legislation, that could be, but I just needed that bit of information. So, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome. Representative Cox.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think the... when I first started working here in the legislature, this is one of the reports that really intrigued me when it came out, mainly because it's a little confusing to try to digest what was going on. And I think picking up on what Representative Dempsey said, it almost seemed like there was statute law in place that might possibly be being ignored on some kind of a deal-making arrangement with other states and other schools in the states and so forth. And that does seem strange. On the other hand, I think it's clear that if you're going to have a plan in place to get reciprocity agreements, and you probably can't just not have it in statute and have a handshake and hope everything works well, because somebody could come up and say, no, you know, we just really don't want to pay anymore. And then without having regulations, they all kind of look at each other and wonder what's going on. And I do support Representative Opeth's idea here to get a report, mainly because I think we will probably get information back that will be very good for us to look at, that will include things other than what the actual dollar cost, either to the student, to the state, or whatever may be on the education thing, because we've got a lot of things that relate to this, and I, that's why I especially like the report in that it talked about how many students are paying W-2 income on more than $20,000 a year, for example, and within so many years after graduation, and all those things are, and I correct me if I'm wrong, Representative Opeth, but when I see your bill that says the report will include feasibility and impacts, I think that's pretty open. We can ask for and hope to get a variety of information that would come back to us on things like that. this kind of report is very good. I also agree with Representative Carlson. I think it would be a little easier to deal with South Dakota if we didn't hear those dang radio ads coming on all the time about that we want you to move your business to South Dakota and so forth, because our taxes are so low. Because we all know that we make appropriations to our schools here, and I assume they make some to their schools. And we also know that we operate things in Minnesota that simply other states are not able to get, whether it's a college of veterinary or whatever it is. They come here to do that, and we support them. So we all know that, and I'm just basically saying to support the idea of getting a report, and I appreciate you bringing it forward, Representative Wolfatz, because I think it will give us some information and maybe open the dialogue. It may not generate any money. I mean, we end up having that talk, having that report, and look at it and say, you know, we're okay. Because if you haven't noticed, we get a lot of your kids coming over here and staying here and paying taxes to Minnesota. So we're fine letting it go that way, and we're not going to try to send you an education bill, if that's what it comes out. But at least we'll know what it is, and I think that's what we're looking for, is the knowledge.
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just leaned over and asked Representative Carlson here, because I wasn't familiar, but I think typically there's we say when the report is due and where it's filed. Otherwise, we could become a victim of the same process again. If it's just kind of an ambiguous thing. Should we address that and say it should be filed at a certain place at a certain time so that there's a higher level of accountability?
Representative Lopez?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, I might defer to Ms. Novak, but I think January 10th, 2006 is one reporting. Mm-hmm. Well, that's the South Dakota provision.
Mr. Chair and members, that's correct. The report under Section 1 of House File 67 is submitted annually to the committees of the legislature that have responsibility for higher education. There isn't a date for the annual report. It is annual.
Would you be objecting to putting in a date
on the first day of session or something? So
again, maybe a little history would be helpful here, Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland. I probably, and Ms. Novak could probably tell me exactly, but I probably introduced a dozen bills related to this. Everything from very prescriptively demanding that these be changed such that students from other states at least pay what our own students pay, to data collection, to a whole number of things. This is pretty soft peddling. This is saying do something that, in a way, they'll probably come up and say, we're already doing, we're already making all these reports. I guess, you know, the concern I think the committee should have, what will this really do? Will we really address some of the problems that are being brought to us today by the legislative auditor, the problems brought to us by the University of Minnesota that's seeing students paying $2,800 less up at Morris than our own Minnesota students? Does asking for a report and encouraging some research get us there? Frankly, I'm a little doubtful, but that's what this bill would do, is, again, trying to send a message both to DSO and to these other states that there's a concern here. And if I can share one other thing, Mr. Chair. You'll notice in your packet I did include an amendment. I'm not going to offer the amendment now, but I wanted to share with you what an amendment would look like if it did what the University of Minnesota is asking us to do, which is to treat Wisconsin like we do treat North and South Dakota with respect to determining the tuition rate that Wisconsin students should pay, such that this would provide for negotiations of the agreement so that they would pay what Minnesota students pay, the higher the tuition rate Wisconsin versus Minnesota. So that's what this amendment does, but obviously that's much more aggressive. I should also tell you, on my bill as it stands without this amendment, there is no fiscal note. I mean, there is a fiscal note, but there's no cost as determined by finance. So, but this amendment, there would definitely be a fiscal impact. And the question is, how do you handle it? Since the university, of course, would now be collecting all those extra tuition dollars, do we sort of balance that out against the general fund cost, the payment to Wisconsin? Those are questions that I think we need to ask. But I guess I would just as we have this conversation, as we move toward an omnibus bill, continue the conversation about how, what should be included in addressing some of the concerns that I think we've had on our plate for a number of years now, but it does seem like it's coming back repeatedly, and I think there's a growing concern that we need to address it more aggressively.
Representative Eastman, does that cover your questions?
Well, it does, but I guess if we're actually going to pass this thing, it would be nice to have a date on there. I mean, like, maybe I could just make a little oral amendment or something. I mean, just for discussion here on line 12, must annually, before the last day of January, submit a report. I don't know, something, so that there's some kind of a deadline in there that we...
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Eastman, we'll... Maybe Ms. Novak can help us get it in a proper order, but before we put the omnibus bill together, as we have these conversations, I may come up and work with the chair and others to put some language together that we can kind of find a consensus, because I've heard a number of comments and concerns, and so I think it sounds like we want to do something. The question is, what's the right balance?
Okay. Is that an actual amendment? We're just
if it'll be addressed,
we'll deal with it.
That's okay.
With that's satisfactory. Mm-hmm. Representative Abrams, I have a question before you question.
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman.
Does your phone play the Gopher or the Minnesota Rouser also?
My phone is programmed for the 2005-2006 Minnesota Orchestra program, and there are applications for annual subscriptions in my office if anybody's interested.
I knew that.
More
early
than you wanted.
I just wanted a yes or no.
Mr. Chairman, when he mentions the Minnesota Orchestra, a few years ago we discovered that on different nights... my wife Carol and I had the same seats that Representative Abrams and his wife had. I don't know if you recall that.
I recall that one.
But my phone isn't so geared. I should do that.
Representative Abrams, you had a question?
Well, it's kind of a question and a comment, and it is almost like, oh, if only life were so easy. And... you know, Representative Opatz has had an interest in this issue, and you know, having himself do a little bit more work on this area and to dig a little bit deeper probably is probably a pretty good idea. But our relationship with our neighbors is a lot more complex than simply having a tuition reciprocity agreement in place. I'll tell you that I'm probably public enemy number one among the St. Croix Valley legislators in Madison, given some of the things that we did in 2003 regarding the income tax reciprocity and required payments from Wisconsin. And then there is the whole issue of growth and coordination in metropolitan areas, not only Minneapolis-St. Paul, but also in the Winona area and all the way up the river in the Duluth Superior area. And what would concern me is not in Representative Opatz's bill, but in the amendment, is if we are trying to micromanage every aspect of that relationship. I certainly understand why the university is concerned about some students paying $2,300 less at Morris. Valid issue. But I don't think that we can unilaterally settle that issue without Wisconsin wanting to unilaterally settle some issues with us. So, while I think it's a good idea to give HESO a little bit of guidance from time to time, I think that we also better take a look at the big picture and understand that our relationship with our friends to the east is intertwined in a number of areas in a number of ways, and we certainly don't want to get involved in a tit-for-tat sort of exercise, because once a relationship starts to unravel, I think everybody's going to be hurt. What we ought to be trying to do, and I think what Representative Opatz wants to do, is make reciprocity more of a win-win situation for both Minnesota and Wisconsin. There's a feeling that we're not getting quite our fair share, but let's be careful as we're treading in this area.
Representative Opatch, do you want ESO to come to the table if they're willing?
Mr. Chair, I'm assuming ESO and others may want to weigh in on this as well.
Is there someone who would like to come before the committee for a few minutes?
Well, Chairman and members, my name is Mark Kansen. I'm with the Higher Education Services Office. Just a few points on the bill itself for Representative and he's right, we'll come up here and say that we're doing some of this reporting already, but we're more than happy to be more formal about it, whatever date that you prefer, it doesn't really matter. We have Jack Reaver, who was before you a few weeks ago, I guess last week rather, that extensive analysis in this area, and certainly willing to do whatever you need to better understand the program and the problems. So whatever date ends up in the bill or in the file and active law, it's fine with us. And any kind of reporting you require would be fine with us as well. On the South Dakota issue, just a few points. We actually have a conference call set up with them, I believe, on Friday. So we are listening and have initiated things. And it's not just that the bills we're introduced, we've actually been dealing with Wisconsin and North Dakota for the last few months. North Dakota came down here, had a conversation with about 3 or 4 people. We had a conference call with the Wisconsin representative and have another one set up for next Monday. So we're talking with people about potential issues. On the South Dakota issue, I'm actually very concerned about the numbers that have been used here, the $350,000 or $1 million or however that is constructed. Let me just quote a few things. From the reports from the auditor itself last year, again, on page 53, they say that interstate payments between the two states have not been computed for many years, and higher education staff in Minnesota and South Dakota, with whom we spoke, were uncertain about how they might today be applied the method that was outlined in the agreement. If the people that work with us every day are uncertain, I'm concerned that you draw any kind of conclusions and have time to sit down and work through the numbers. And then Jack Rayburn, in the fiscal notes that you have, at the bottom of page 2, says, talks about this issue about the payments between the two states, and he says that as such it would be inappropriate to assume South Dakota would owe Minnesota because more South Dakota students were enrolled in Minnesota in fall 2003. And this has to do with not just the number of students enrolled, but tuition payments between the two and how those calculations are determined. So it's not that they may or may not owe us money, it's that we don't know, and I'd rather leave it at that until we actually can do the analysis, which I think is important to do. No question about that. The decision made in 1988 about why those things were waived is something I don't have any knowledge of. And it's something we should be visiting. We'll do that again on Friday when we talk to the South Dakota representatives. The one other issue about Wisconsin then, certainly again, as I mentioned, we're dealing with Wisconsin. We've looked at Senator Representative Lopez's amendment about conclusions to a negotiation. I'd only say that, like all negotiations, there's two sides to the deal, and the other side cannot agree to the deal. I understand that the legislature is concerned about the fairness issue. We're certainly aware of that. Although, historically, you can look back at the differential tuition rates at all campuses and see that they are high now. They're not as high as they were 2 years ago, but they've always been different. Substantially different. $800 to $1,000 difference between, say, a Wisconsin student attending Twin City campus as opposed to a Minnesota student going to the Madison campus. So where were those things? As Representative Wolfett said, an amendment like his or bills floating around, I know there's dealt with this in the Senate yesterday, that leads to a change in the tuition payments for Wisconsin students would have a general fund cost. We think it's in the range of $6 to $8 million annually. But again, we're working on that analysis. And we'll redo the fiscal note, actually with this in mind, so that should that conversation come up, we'd be prepared to respond to it.
All right, thank you. Representative Carlson.
Chairman, I have the audit report open to that page 53 that you alluded to, and I'm not sure what you're saying then when I read this. One calculation that the auditor put together was that it would be $1 million for 0102 under one calculation, and then under another calculation with the improvements that are discussed, it could drop to 350. But it would seem to me that it's a significant amount either way, but when it's as much as $1 million under one calculation for 0102, and then we go back to 1989 since there's been a payment, I mean, there's accumulatively potentially some rather significant number. I don't know what to attach to it, but there's been some calculations that show a significant swing. Now, I don't know if the auditor, it sounds like the auditor calculated those numbers. Maybe they calculated those numbers based on information from you folks. I'm not sure just how that came about. But if you could explain maybe a little bit more of what you're talking about relative to the actual numbers that are on that page.
Sure, Representative Carlson, it's the sentence I just cited. If you're uncertain how to apply it, why would you try to do something different? And the auditor may have done, I assume these are auditor's numbers, and they may be based on information that they received from Jack Raver, I'm not sure. I'd rather do things under some sense of certainty about how you apply formulas and things like that, as opposed to being speculative about it. You know, that's what concerns me.
It appears, though, that they gave us quite a range here, 350 to 1, so they weren't, I don't read that, but they were trying to nail it down to a real specific number like you would perhaps like to do, but they, when they gave us that range of from 350 to 1 million, depending on how you calculate it, my point is that it's significant under almost any calculation, especially when you look at it over a period of 16 years, but maybe you'll be able to provide us more precise information at some point in the future, but I think some of us are concerned, but I have a question of you, if he saw it. You know, there's been a lot of publicity of late since the passing of former Governor Elmer Anderson, and when we were talking about the reciprocity, I remember talking with him years ago, not long after he had completed the study that was this Blue Ribbon Commission that he chaired on higher education. And one of the things that he advocated was that Minnesota open its borders and that we charge out-of-state students the same rate we would charge Minnesota students. Now, that's a rather interesting discussion today when we have as much as a $2,800 differentiation. I think you and Representative Lopez mentioned that as far as Morris was concerned. But any thoughts or any calculations on how that kind of an approach would work would eliminate the need for any reciprocity agreement, at least for those that are coming into Minnesota. But we did have a former governor who was very interested in higher education put that on the table, and it was, quite frankly, sort of generally ignored at the time because of concern about the state share of the investment in education and one thing or another. But he was trying to make us a, we'll quote another governor, the brain power state, but they were both on the same page relative to that kind of an investment.
You want to identify yourself?
Mr. Chairman, Tricia Grimes from the Higher Education Services Office. If I could just back up a minute to some of the broader principles. My understanding of one of the things that went on in saying that Minnesota and South Dakota staff were uncertain as to how the calculation would work is that since it's been a number of years since any payment was calculated or made, the states would have to agree between each other how a new calculation or a resumed calculation would work. And so until they have worked through those steps of agreements, it's a little hard to say exactly how much money anyone might be talking about here. I think one of the features of tuition reciprocity is that it establishes what tuition the students from each state will pay when attending the other. In the absence of a tuition reciprocity agreement,
South Dakota has made it pretty clear that they would let Minnesota attend schools in their state and not pay out-of-state tuition, in which case their tuition would be substantially cheaper than Minnesota's, and there would be a positive incentive, for financial incentive, for Minnesota students to attend there. And so when the subject of South Dakota having to pay Minnesota came up, my recollection is that if Minnesota tried to push too hard on insisting on payment, South Dakota would then start raising the subject of, well, gee, maybe they would just not have an agreement. And then they could be sure that their tuition would provide a financial incentive for Minnesota students to attend in South Dakota. So these are some of the dances that go on in coming up with these agreements between states. And it's my understanding that HESO at the time made the judgment and consulted with appropriate legislative leadership that, well, we wanted Minnesota students to have the opportunity, and we wanted some of the South Dakota students to have the opportunity to come in here, and so maybe it wasn't worth letting the agreement stop existing just in order to get a few hundred thousand dollars. I'm not absolutely sure that's exactly how the discussion went, but that's the general recollection that I have, and that is the kind of dance that goes on between states in these discussions. I just think it's important to remember that all three of the other major states that we have reciprocity agreements with have public sector tuition that is lower than ours. And one of the principles that HESO has been trying to get in place is that at least there not be a financial incentive for students to leave Minnesota. And that's been one of the principles we've been operating under.
Now, Mr. Chairman, I'm not pushing Elmer Anderson's approach. In fact, I was chair of this committee at the time that came about, and we, like I say, just generally ignored it because there were repercussions. But in today's environment, it creates a rather interesting discussion. What you're telling me is that there's somebody of the Elmer Anderson philosophy in South Dakota that would view it as a way to attract students.
Any further discussion or otherwise, we will take House File 67 and lay it over for possible inclusion.
Thank you very much.
You want a lot of questions? Oh, yeah.
We're going to amend that
state. Okay. Yeah. A lot of germane amendments for you.
Mr. Chair, good afternoon.
Thank you, Representative Nordness. You have a House File 1085.
That's correct, House File 1085, and I believe we'd also move this to include it in our omnibus bill. Is that first we?
All right, so you'd like to move the bill before us for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill?
I think that's the right.
Okay. Tell us about your bill.
House File 1085. Simply makes a change in date for the Minnesota State College and University Student Association. So here to talk about that date change is
Thank you, Representative Arnes.
Welcome to our committee, and if you'd state your name and tell us who you're with.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, my name is J.J. Jopi, and I'm with the Minnesota State University Student Association. And first of all, I'd like to thank Representative Nornis for his help on this bill. It's kind of a minor little change that we've been looking at to the statute that points that we've been an opportunity to make recommendations to the governor for the student trustees on the Board of Trustees. Let me go over a couple quick things for you just so you kind of have an idea of what how the board works and how these appointments work. There are 15 board members on the Board of Trustees, 12 are citizens, and 3 are students, one from the state universities, one from the state technical colleges, and one from the state community colleges. All 15 members are appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. And the 12 citizen members are actually, there's a group called the Trustee Candidate Advisory Council that interviews candidates and makes recommendations to the governor whenever there's an appointment up. For example, if there's an appointment up this July 1st, they would be recruiting and interviewing candidates, possible candidates, and then make recommendations to the governor by April 15th. So then the governor could make an appointment by the 1st of July. And similarly, with the student associations, both mine and the State University Student Association and the State College Student Association have an opportunity to interview candidates and make recommendations to the governor for the appointments for our positions on the state, on the Board of Trustees. But unfortunately, for some reason, the statute states that our associations have to have our recommendations to the governor by January 1st of the year when the appointment isn't done until July 1st, or the person doesn't start until July 1st. So this bill would just kind of align it with the Trustee Candidate Advisory Council, make it a little bit simpler. And as you can imagine, students trying to make a decision for that long of a period of time ahead of when they're going to be making a two-year commitment to be on the Board of Trustees is rather difficult, whether they're staying in school or whether they're going to be leaving school after the appointment is made. So I just had brought this both to Representative Nornes and Senator Pappas and hope we can make a change in the law this year. I'll stand for any questions if anybody has anything.
Mr. Dovey, do you have any difficulty recruiting students for these positions?
No, Mr. Chair, not at all, actually. We have multiple applications. The statute actually allows us to recommend 2 to 4 candidates to the governor each of the years. We don't usually have much of a problem at all. Sometimes we have a surplus of them, actually.
Okay. Other questions for testifier? All right. Thank you very much. And we will lay this bill over for inclusion in the possible inclusion in the House Omnibus Education Bill. Thank you.
That was weak and soft. Really smooth operation. I better not ask that. This is way quicker. Must be the chair that made it.
The final item on our agenda is University of Minnesota, St. Paul Campus Day, the capital, and Bob, LD is it? Bob, welcome to our committee. You need to use... Now, we don't have the same high tech that some of the other committee rooms do. We need a projector.
No.
Don't we?
We just need
to project it on the screen? Oh, okay. We do have high tech. I'm sorry. Except we're missing the cord.
Medium tech.
Medium tech.
We need a projector.
Oh,
lifesaver.
Well, I can't see the
clock. Don't need a connection.
Well, I can't see the clock. I'm going to get out of here.
Have you got all the wires at that HUD?
Tell us when it's time. We interview. Rescue us. I mean, yeah.
You can see right on there, too.
And you're trained to operate?
Oh, I was just kidding. It's one of the high points you guys. We're all bad.
Right under the table.
No. I think it's under our table.
Here. That is the one right there.
No, it's okay.
That's
a water main. Yeah.
What?
Is
it
there?
I don't know.
It's
access for the...
You guys are...
Mice.
It's a mice connection.
Mm-hmm.
Big, big orange cord. I don't know.
I could trip.
Good point.
Probably about 70 foot or 70 inch.
Like a deer.
There we go. Yeah. Box. Holy cow.
Okay, we're getting close.
Gadzooks. Now we'll all fall asleep.
We're not quite level with the world.
I used to teach an all-out scale that used a little book or something. And she's got a file for you.
There we go.
Just for information, who's covered?
That's pretty close. I think we can handle it.
87 million.
Oh, low time.
Okay, please introduce yourself. You might want to pick the microphone up and bring it over closer to you. You
can do that. No one pays attention to you. No one pays attention.
Thank you. I'm Robert Eldy. I'm Dean of the College of Biological Sciences at the University of Minnesota, and I'm pleased for the opportunity to testify for your committee today. I would like to outline what has happened at the University of Minnesota in the biology.
I have to have you slide over just a little bit because you're
okay.
There you go.
Wanted to review with you what has happened in the last decade in terms of the disciplines of biology at the University of Minnesota, because the state of Minnesota and the university have partnered to make some serious investments that have really transformed the opportunities. And I'd like to then point out what we see as the future and how we need to continue to make investments. I'll argue that the university, as a higher ed institution, is really all about students. And I think we have moved our operations in dramatic ways to provide transformational education in the context of the research university. Students who come to us as undergraduates and leave with a bachelor's degree or a master's or a PhD are transformed not by just what happens in the classroom, but by what happens in those laboratories and field research stations. In ways that other institutions here in Minnesota simply cannot do because of the research enterprise that we're fortunate to be able to conduct at the University of Minnesota. When we started a decade ago, biology was what we now can call pre-genomics. That is, we did not know the genome or the sequence, the genetic blueprint of any living organism. Today, we know the sequence of any organism we want to. And the cost of determining that sequence has dropped dramatically, and the time to do it has dropped dramatically. 10 years ago, we embarked on a process of reorganizing biology, so now we have partnership departments, partnerships between the College of Biological Sciences and the medical school for two of our core departments, partnerships with the College of Agriculture, Food, and Environmental Sciences, and partnerships with the Institute of Technology. We've broken down silos that existed a decade ago. And seeing that progress, Mark Udoff joined us a couple of years later in 1997, and based on those reorganized departments, launched, with your help, his initiative on molecular and cellular biology. With that initiative, we have now hired 41 new faculty, part through reallocation of our own resources and part through the resources you provided. We've built new buildings. The buildings are amazing and wonderful. The molecular cellular biology building on the Minneapolis campus, the Cargill building for microbial and plant genomics on the St. Paul campus, that was a partnership 50-50 between the state of Minnesota and the gift from Cargill. We created BioDale, your one-stop shopping mall for all of your biotechnology needs on the St. Paul campus. And the translational research facility is heading toward completion at about the 1st of July of this year. So things have truly been transformed, both in terms of the physical plant, the facilities, and the infusion of new people and new ideas. It's truly transformed. I think I just said this. We can skip right on ahead. This provides, these infusions really provide new and unprecedented opportunities for our students and new deliverables for the people of Minnesota. So where are we now? Well, we're at the stage where we're moving rapidly beyond genomics. I mean, it's almost impossible to think about this, that, let me just back up and just tell you one factoid about the magnitude of these genomics projects. Inside of every cell in our body, there is our genome. Okay? So our genome is found inside the nucleus, inside the DNA of every cell in our body. That amounts to 3 billion letters of the four-letter alphabet, A, T, G, C, code. So I'm going to give you a little quiz here, as a, you know, I can't get the professor out of a person like me. So the 3 billion letters, how many pages do you think it would take to print out 3 billion letters? That's found inside, you know, submicroscopically inside of each one of our cells. You know, 10 pages, 100 pages, 1,000 millions. I'm going to get a good answer.
How many letters on a page?
It depends on the font.
Yeah, the font. Just like our students, you know, they need to do a 10-page report, you know, so they make a real big font.
It actually would turn out, if you print it out in a font about the size of a telephone directory, it would take a stack of telephone directories as tall as the Washington Monument to take the printed information that's stored inside of the nucleus of every one of our cells. So it's amazing that we could do
this much in this decade, and so now where are we going in this next decade? Well, we're going beyond the genome to what we call the proteome. So the genome is the storage, it's the blueprint and the storage pool of information. The proteins are the little nanoscale machines that do the work inside of all of our cells. They, you know, our muscles move because of these nanoscale machines. Those proteins, in turn, are, some of them are enzymes, and they make metabolites. We need to analyze all of the metabolites all at once. And all of that kind of rolls up, eventually, to what we now call systems biology. So new disciplines that we never even imagined have been born just in the past few years. Because of the breakdown of silos by our reorganization, we've dramatically increased the collaboration across units at the university. We have, for example, because of buildings like the Cargill Building, faculty from the medical school working elbow to elbow with people from the Department of Plant Pathology, people working on malaria and wheat rust side by side, because the conceptual principles of how you do this new biology are the same, whether you're trying to tackle malaria or rust. It's truly a very different place. We've launched University Enterprise Laboratories, the incubator facility, laboratory-based incubator facility for startup companies in collaboration with many partners from industry. We've launched, with help from you folks 2 years ago, using the Renewable Development Fund as a part of the Prairie Island reauthorization and the Conservation Improvement Program funds, the Initiative for Renewable Energy in the Environment. And now President Brunix, having inherited a strong platform of biology, has his series of bioscience initiatives that I'll say a bit more about in just a few minutes. We have dramatically ramped up the quality and the demand for our undergraduate programs. Most of our undergraduate programs in the biological disciplines have been doubled in size over the past decade. We have some nation-leading innovation going on in our undergraduate programs. And we have challenges now that we're trying to address with respect to the size, the size which is too small, and the quality of our undergraduate, of our graduate programs compared to our peer institutions. So what have we learned? Well, we've learned that new facilities are a magnet for attracting the best faculty and the best students. I told you that we've hired 41 new faculty through this initiative in Molecular Insider Biology. We didn't hire a bunch of dogs. We hired dream teams of amazing people. We went head-to-head with the best institutions in the country and got the best, in part due to these great new facilities. What we've also learned as we started down this pathway is these great new people that we've attracted attract even more great people. And I think these are the two bottom-line principles that we've uncovered. And then we find that we have, through this recruiting effort and through the building effort, the morale of our faculty is at an all-time high. They are energized and working night and day.
And the momentum that we've established is really a priceless commodity. And these two, our morale and our momentum, have been verified and established by outside review panels that have come to review this initiative in molecular and cellular biology and what it's done to transform the university. So where are we going? President Brunix has five bioscience-based initiatives. The initiative called Healthy Foods, Healthy Lives, Translational Research in Human Health, New Products Through Biotechnology, Brain Function Across the Lifespan, and Environment and Renewable Energy. All of these initiatives, I think you can recognize, are a consequence of the university understanding in new ways its responsibility to deliver outcomes to the community. Mark Udoff's initiative in molecular and cellular biology sort of just focused on the science in and of itself. But he said to me, as he said to many of us, and he was in his inimitable way kind of drag his finger at me and say about the molecular and cellular biology initiative, Elby, if this initiative just adds a little more ivory to the ivory tower, it's failed. It's got to do things to transform Minnesota's economy. And I think that's what you see reflected here in the President Brunig's bioscience initiatives. These are all focused on that output of transforming life as we know it here in Minnesota, and then spreading beyond Minnesota to the nation and to the world. As you have seen, we have a request before you, $84 million across the biennium, and it includes, among other things, expanding our research opportunities in the biosciences, continued recruitment and retention of top faculty, students, and staff, and investments in the ever-expanding needs and rapidly turning over needs for new research infrastructure. So where are we going? Biology is rapidly advancing. There's no area in any scientific enterprise or in any academic enterprise that is changing so rapidly. Chemistry is not changing like biology. Physics is not changing. Astronomy is not changing. The most rapidly changing and expanding discipline is biology. Many of the problems that we face as societies, from personal problems, our personal health, problems of obesity, problems of neurodegenerative diseases, to problems with the health of our ecosystems, are fundamentally biological problems. And the new tools and the deep understanding in this post-genomics period of biology give us new opportunities, as I'll outline in just a minute, to intervene for the better. And that's why President Brunick's initiatives really focus on the biosciences to a very large extent. We need ongoing investments in order to support the continuous infusions of new ideas and new technologies. We can't walk away from it. And to the point that biology is at a different state, I have a quotation here from Robert Brown, the provost of MIT, and professor of chemical engineering, who, by the way, is coming here next week to deliver a seminar on science education at the University of Minnesota. Bob says, the emergence of biological engineering is a sign of biology's maturity. It was only when chemistry advanced with a strong quantitative approach that it was possible to begin chemical engineering. Now biology has reached that point. Biology is at the point of engineering cells and molecules, to the point where futurists look ahead and say the economy that we're about to enter into is changing from the information-based economy to a molecular economy. The economy where the value added is the value we add to molecules, molecules that we harvest from biological systems, like the corn we grow in our fields. Point, MIT is the first university in the nation to announce that they have launched the first new major in 29 years, and it's called biological engineering. And in the Boston Globe just 2 weeks ago, the following quotation, once cutting-edge materials of engineering or steel girders, then transistors. Next, MIT is gambling with DNA and cells, which gets to this point of these new products and new possibilities being delivered to the market. So how do we look 10 years out from now? We've looked backwards over the past decade and seen that, in fact, things have changed dramatically. And we've been able, with your help, to put a rudder in the water and steer that change for the better of Minnesota. So our vision for the year 2015, of course, can't be as crisp as looking backwards to see where we've come, but we believe that we need to advance biology through truly transformative research and education. And our provost and president are holding us deans and administrators to that at the university. We transform students. We bring students to the university whose opportunities and lives are changed fundamentally by what they learn and pick up as partners with us in these research and educational teams. And we would argue that we transform the quality of life in Minnesota by using biology to improve human health, the environment, and the economy. As we look out at that decade from now, research will, at the interface of disciplines, we need to take more risks and be responsible for a higher level of innovation. We say here more in silico research to complement in vitro. In vitro is the Latin word for in a dish, essentially. Biology in a dish or in a culture dish, which is the way an awful lot of biology is done today. In silico means we're going to be doing a lot of biology increasingly on machines like this, and very powerful machines. I think you know that IBM Rochester is leading the world's fastest supercomputer is called BlueGene. It's made by the team at IBM Rochester. And it's tackling these gigantic database problems and questions, a question where the telephone books as tall as the Washington Monument have to be digested and made understandable to us. And IBM is taking that on in spades. We have to provide opportunities to allow our faculty to take risks and be innovative, and we have to bring more of our faculty up to speed in math and engineering principles. With my own college, we're now entering about 350 undergrads per year. We anticipate by 10 years out we'll be up to 500 or so. We'll be a much more diverse undergraduate class. Biology will be much more integrated with math and engineering. We'll have succeeded in funding and stabilizing our grad programs. And increasingly, the graduates are going directly to work in the bioscience or biotechnology industry that's being created in Minnesota. So to end, I'll go back to the beginning and reiterate that really it all begins with students and what we do to transform their lives. Because after all, that's the future. That's the things that we're uncovering that will enable them, it's going to be on their back, to solve these problems that we in part have created and identified the beginnings of solutions. So with that, I thank you very much for your attention and would be pleased if there are questions to try to address them.
Okay, thank you very much. That is a task at Park that I'm looking at, right?
I would say exactly, Mr. Chairman. This is the beginning of the, and I can go on and just with 30 seconds, your permission in 30 seconds, say that, you know, we use this metaphorically. We have the Lake Itasca research station where for now 95 years people have been doing great research and students have been learning about big picture biology, and we now bring all of our incoming freshmen for orientation up to Itasca, where we call the orientation nature of life. And so both literally and figuratively, they begin their academic journey where this great Mississippi River begins its journey down to the Gulf of Mexico. And you're absolutely right, this is the beginning of that river.
Any questions? Representative Carlson.
You say all your students, you're talking about in biological
science. Biological science.
Just curious, thank you.
Well, it has to be really exciting to see. You've been teaching for how long?
Well, Chairman, I've been at the university. I actually came to the university as a graduate student in 1969. I went away for about 3 years as a postdoctoral fellow, but came back and joined the faculty in 1977. And I've been dean of the College of Biological Sciences for the past decade.
See these changes coming so rapidly now after all those years, that's got to be, again, exciting and energizing and rewarding.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, it really is. I mean, it's and what is so energizing to me personally and then to the people of the university is that, you know, the kind of assistance you've provided through the initiative in Lectin Center Biology, through the initiative in renewable energy and environment, we've really been able to capitalize on these changes and not be bystanders watching that world rush past us. We've been able to participate in many cases at the leading edge, which is right where we need to be.
Sure. Representative Carlson.
During your presentation, you mentioned the enthusiasm of the people that you've been able to hire and bring in. And we've had testimony last biennium from the president about the necessity because of the state's budget problems and unfortunate reductions to the university for their funding, that there was a salary freeze and one thing another. How has that
impacted your department in terms of attracting and retaining some of these high-quality folks that you said we were very fortunate enough to bring in?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, we've been, you know, it's been a tightrope for sure. Morale and enthusiasm is particularly high in the young people we've been able to bring in. And we were able to bring them in at a salary scale and under compensation plans and setups for their research operations, you know, through the set-asides and reallocation we did at the university and through the resources you made available to us. We've been able to bring them in under pretty competitive terms. As I said, we had to go head-to-head with Michigan, MIT, and everyone else in this group. And you simply don't get these people unless you're at that level. However, with the what we've experienced because of freezes and budget challenges is a dramatic compression of salary. So the veterans who've been slugging away at it for 10 years or 20 years, those people are not seeing the growth of salary that they would see if they were at other institutions. And it's those numbers, and in fact, if you look at those numbers, our compensation numbers are badly compressed as an institution. We're usually able to bring some great people on by squeezing pennies out of every possible corner, but then where we begin to suffer is in our ability to retain those people 10 years into their career. They launch their career here at Minnesota, they become very well known, and then we get rated. And part of the rating is our inability to keep pace on salary at the mid-career levels. And I would also argue that we've, great faculty need great graduate students. And one of the things that I alluded to and is part of our biennial request is we've realized that as important as compensation might be to keep retaining faculty, being able to recruit the very best graduate students is important. And, of course, recruiting those students incurs costs because those students are supported with TA-ships and RA-ships, and we're not at all competitive in that realm due to the way that we've been funding that. So I think at least as big an issue as compensation, and that's a big one, is our ability to provide great grad students.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your presentation.
And thank you for your attention.
That concludes our meeting.